Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Thriving Minds podcast. I am Professor Selena Bartlett. And today, in this heartwarming episode of our podcast, we dive deep into the philosophy of Ubuntu. It's a powerful concept from Africa that teaches us, I am because we are. It's such a beautiful philosophy because it wraps us all in a shared humanity. It's emphasizing the importance of community, compassion, and mutual care. We explore how this idea of interconnectedness, which we're now seeing through in neuroscience of two and being able to measure interbrain synchrony, it doesn't just enrich our lives, but it's essential for our collective well-being. And it's the hope to unlock neuroplasticity and a new future in terms of mental health and well-being. So today joining us is Kelly Hackney. She's the author of a compelling chapter in a book, and it was called Interwoven: Shared Stories, Shared Humanity. She's also a leader at the Canopy, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting families and communities. She is going to share with us today her inspiring story and journey of overcoming adversity, including battles with addiction and mental health, and how the principles of Interwoven and Ubuntu have played a crucial role in her healing, neuroplasticity, as I'd like to say, and success. Kelly, thank you so much for giving up your time today and telling everyone about you and the amazing work you do. So welcome, Kelly.
Thank you, Selena. Thanks for having me.
It's a joy to have you. That piece you wrote in that book chapter is just beautiful. And I'm going to share a little bit out of that book today as well. But do you want to start by telling us a little bit about your journey and the role that Ubuntu or being interwoven in your community has played in your life?
My name's Kelly, and I'm a leader of a group of family workers and social workers who help families be the best and parents be the best that they can be. And I've been doing this work for about 15 years, but prior to that, I had my own journey of mental health issues, addiction, and I was unwell. When I finished school, I actually became a primary school teacher, so I was able to be quite successful and attend school and attend, but I guess the dysfunction and the coping strategies that I tried to I think I was living a life of running and numbing.
Yes.
And I could not run and numb any longer.
Yes. So if you don't mind sharing a little bit, because I think this is the bit we don't like talking about in our society. It stays in silence and everyone is running and numbing in their own way. And that's what my research has shown over a really long period of time. It's also my sister's story, my story. I would say it's a very, very, very common untold story. It is told, but only for people that are looking or reading. How did you come to see or become aware of that? Because that's the key, isn't it? Most of us, or many people, and this is why I don't think much is changing in the space. It's getting better. But why can't we bring this knowledge, education out into the public spaces, into all the organizations? This lived experience, this story is so important, and it is the key that allowed you to change your life, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, a school of psychology has been what's been wrong with you, and then that's now shifted to what happened to you. And I'm curious if we change the question to who are you? Because it's when we connect to that inner person, that inner creation that each one of us is unique, that they bring to the world, that genius that is within inside them. I think that that's when they can come alive. And that's who I realized I was running and numbing from. I thought it was from the pain. You know, I had bouts of not wanting to, like wanting to die, but it actually wasn't that I wanted to die. I just didn't want to live. I didn't want to live with the pain. And so I was fortunate along the way, and this is what I write about in my chapter in Ubuntu, is about the amazing encounters with a handful of people, and there's been way more than a handful, let me tell you, that have impacted my life and my journey, and right down to children that I have taught at school, there's been an interaction, and that has led me to actually change how I see and think about things. But this handful that I talked about in this book, They offered me a gift that I think is such a priceless gift, it's such a valuable gift, but one that is so freely that we can give away as well. And that is, they saw me. They looked beyond the disorder, the dysfunction, the labels, the addiction, and they saw me. It wasn't about their job or what they did. It was about who they were and who they invited me to be. And it kind of interrupted the trajectory of my life. It gave me a new way of seeing and being.
Yeah, it's and you talk about in your chapter menders and healers and igniters, and these are the incredible individuals that are out across a wide swath of our society that are doing it in silence, and they're incredible individuals who repair not just the physical breaks but the emotional ones, and they're knitting the fabric of our communities tighter with every compassionate act. You also
Absolutely.
highlight igniters, or the creatives and the dreamers, who inspire us to see beyond our current circumstances and envision a world filled with hope and possibility. How have the menders, healers, and igniters you've encountered shaped your path to recovery and success now that you also are a mender, healer, and an igniter?
Yeah, well, I see menders, healers, igniters, illuminators every day all over the place. And like you said, they're not looking for accolades, they're just going about connecting with people. And that's to me is, I guess, the first and foremost, that they're actually stopping and seeing people. They're not automatically working, they're not automatically just processing, in their work or in their roles, but they're actually connecting. They're seeing the person. I felt seen by each of the people that I talk about in the book. Marg, I talk about how she taught me how to see and be in the world, that she interrupted the narrative that I was living and the trajectory that people who've had my experience, I experienced childhood sexual abuse, was a victim of a pedophile group. And then when that went to court, it was thrown out, and my mental health used against me in that. So I had to rebuild my life, my truth, my story, my experience was, it was as though it said that didn't happen. And it's like, well, I know it happened. How do I rebuild this? And so
Yes.
that sent me on a journey over 20 years ago. And that journey, it actually for a long while, I separated my professional and my personal. In fact, I was told I'd never work again. I had an incident at work, and it was on work cover, and then they put me through, different psychiatrists and psychologists, and the reports came back she'll never work again. And I think when I heard my psychologist tell me that, that was a report that went to her, I'm like, I don't believe that. And she said, I don't believe it either. And I think for me it was a turning point. It's like, don't put me in a box. I can't, like, I know I've got these labels, I've had these diagnoses, I've had these experiences, but it's not who I am. It's not when I came to the earth, that was what not the gift that came with me. And
No,
so
it didn't. It didn't, and it's definitely nothing to do with you, to be really frank. I mean, it happened, but it's not like you came into this world full of hope and love, like everyone else did. And this conversation that we're having right this second is it's a conversation no one likes to have, but the most important one we can have as society if we want to really change mental health strategies in the country.
Absolutely. And I think the biggest enemy of that is shame. I really do. I think we're embarrassed.
Well, I get that, because no one likes to talk about the family secrets and shame.
And
And
even shame as a parent to like if there's things happening for their children, the shame of talking about it's like a deficit. But when if we were a great sportsman, we'd get coached and trained, wouldn't we? We would actually, to excel, we would want to do that. We want to be the best parents, but then to get a support or a service, it's almost like a deficit. And that's what the bit that we want to change. You want to make it an encouragement that you want to excel, you get coached, there's training.
yes, and it's the and as a scientist that's been out there trying to understand why my sister ended up with a mental illness, and now I understand it is related to exactly the same problem, and multi-generational, Early life experiences, everything that is written in thousands of research papers now. If we don't change that, we're not going to change the outcomes later. We just can't. It's just going to keep going perpetually because we refuse to talk about it or give people parenting manuals or, and it's no one's fault. This is not against anybody. It's just a conversation that we need to have to go the root causes and protect children, but also. When I had my children, the only thing I learned when I left the hospital and I waited for a long time to have my kids was that how to breastfeed rather than bottle feed and how to put them on their side for sleeping and maybe change a nappy. That was my parenting classes. And so the parenting class for me was obviously what parenting I'd experienced. And that's what we now know for sure is that parenting is just recapitulation, either full on what we had happened to us or completely the opposite of what we had happened to us. There's no kind of manual, as you said. And I think that is the breakthrough that is happening now out there. Many people in the field trying to bring these manuals in, but we're quite reluctant to engage with this as the most important subject that we could have as a society to really make it more thriving.
One of the things that in along my healing journey is that is around, you can't go around it. You've got to go through it. And I think we oversell this, smile and it's a happy life, but there's hard times. There are challenging times and feeling uncomfortable. I think it's been sold as a bad thing, but actually that's the only way through. Sometimes we are uncomfortable if we're changing or learning or growing, but it's the only way through. And I'm kind of we talk in our team about that. It's the through bit.
Yeah, we
The
had, and
psychologist did that. That was what she showed me. The only way is through.
the other cool thing about neuroplasticity, meaning the brain's ability to change and heal through training and effort, is that's the bottom line too, that it only comes through discomfort. Because if you just keep doing the same thing over again, you're not changing anything, are you?
No,
And
you're not.
the pain and discomfort is through the changing part.
Yeah. And I love it. I love that I've got a plastic brain. I love that.
And which brings us to that part of the conversation that I think really has to change, isn't it? Because the science is evolving so rapidly, plus we can see inside the brain, we have to stop the conversation about injury with no recovery to injury with possible recovery because everyone's so different. We can't make guarantees on anything for anybody in anything. But what we can do is at least offer people some kind of pathways or support services that offer that opportunity for change.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the framing of how we frame things is really important. It's not about what we say or what we write. I mean, in the child protection and child wellbeing space, most workers are trauma informed, trauma trained. But if I ask them, what do you think about, not just what you write about, what you know about, what do you think about when you hear, or when you read a report about a child's behavior, are you joining the two? Are you linking them up? Because trauma, the other thing is, I think we think we've come up. I remember in the early days, I thought trauma is what happened to me, but trauma is my response to what happened to me. And therefore, it is changeable. Whereas you can't change necessarily the things that happen, but you certainly can change your reaction to that if you learn new ways of coaching. And in the early days, I was fortunate to be on the first trial of DBT, the dialectical behavior therapy in Australia, which actually was really pivotal. It gave me a language, it gave me skills to really manage my emotions, my regulate my behavior, learn distress tolerance, how to manage when I was distressed. And that was a key to my well-being and my recovery journey as well.
So, do you want to talk about some of those hard moments right in the beginning? Because that's the hardest step, isn't it? The beginning. Like, I know it doesn't happen overnight. It's a process and it's lifelong. But it's what we're trying to do here and help others that are listening, because there's lots of people this will resonate for. It's those first moments of awareness that you can't now unknow what you know. Something must have got said that changed your mind about your trajectory?
Look, when I know when I met with Marg, it was both my experience when she was a counselor at a retreat in the Hunter Valley, and Marg's 80 now, and we've has written a chapter in this book as well, and it's such a privilege to write beside her. Marg, I think my experience of her absolute genuineness, her compassion, her loving kindness, her view of the world, it kind of put me like gave an invitation to me. But I remember early days, I heard the Viktor Frankl quote from The Meaning of Life, that the only true power that we have is our power to choose our response in any situation. And when I read that, it's like, oh, well, how can you choose it? But it's actually a decision to make a choice daily, if not even daily, hourly. And so sometimes it's like, okay, I'm committing to this. Like, if I've got a choice in this, I don't have to be swayed by the opinions or by my trajectory. I can actually choose my response. So can I choose my feelings? Well, if I feel them, then I can choose them. But if I don't feel them, then I can't choose them. And so I had these wonderful professionals beside me who created a space, and I was able to have an accountable relationship with them. So in saying that, if I was off track, I could come back and say, you know, I'm off track. Let's get back on track. Do you know what I mean? That accountability to this is a decision I'm making. I'm not making it out of an emotional heightened space of, you know, yeah, let's go. I'm making it on the days when it's toughest. And, you know, some of the commitment that they gave was, you know, getting me up, you know, ensuring I was up out of bed each day, or, you know, come and picking me up to go and do something. Just that commitment, whether it was a good day or whether it was a not good day, I could still do some things. And another really valuable part I'd really like to share, was with a couple called David and Lorraine, and they're medical professionals, and they actually saw the skills and strengths that I had as well. And so they actually, something different they did was they put me to work. They saw what I could give and opened up spaces for me to contribute back. And I think so much in the mental health space, even in the family support space, in offering a free service. And I don't mean about charging, but, you know, in a space where there's not an ability to contribute back or to give back, we're in time, in resource, or in skill, it kind of diminishes the exchange. And so what I learned from them is just the incredible value of contribution, because even when I felt my lowest, I was still valued and felt like I was a valuable contributor to something.
And you had purpose.
I had purpose.
And so you talk a lot about this in the article about, and this is what Canopy does as well. It's about how to wrap around people around people, because that's the way we heal. It's not, yes, you can do certain things every day on choices, but it's really in partnership with other people that it gets easier with the right
Absolutely.
people that are actually like being seen, like you're being seen for who you actually are, not for what all these other things that were thought of in the past.
Yeah, and I guess what we do is we deliver parenting programs and work alongside parents to build their capacity as parents, manage behaviors, but it goes deeper, and that's the connection part in like what I'm seeing in the community is this overwhelm with parents and an inability to take any more on. And so when they're referred to our service, it's almost like they want it, you know, they want it, but they can't, they haven't got the emotional resource, or even sometimes physical resource to connect. And so what we've been exploring is instead of being adding to that and layering our programs upon, we're searching for what brings energy, what connects to the core energy in that mum, in that dad, in that family, that they come alive within themselves, because that's going to bring real change. Teaching them on top of their overwhelm, providing a program on top of their overwhelm, isn't going to bring change. It's going to maybe change some things for a little while, but then there'll be distraction. So Yeah, it's critical in our work that we actually see people where they're at beyond their labels, that they feel seen too.
So let's talk a little bit about the how we met, and that's through my new book, Being Seen, and how that resonated for you really deeply, but also the contribution now to online interactions and the amount of time everyone's spending online and how that's contributing to the overwhelm, and then of course how it's affecting young children's mental health, and then it's an escalating round circle, and how you see that resonating for your service.
Oh, I think your research and your work, Selena, is critical. It's time critical, and it's critical information that we're missing in, like we've got lots of evidence-based programs and evidence-based work that we do, but this is about relating to another human being, our children, our other family, our other family members. And I think it's an area that we actually haven't dipped into, and I think it's critical in the space of child wellbeing. Our child protection system in New South Wales, there's movement to call it a child connection system, and I love that because it frames it differently, and it actually brings an empowerment rather than an authoritative kind of manner to it, and I think it invites everyone along. That's what we need to happen. There's critical information that I've listened to in your podcast just over the last couple of weeks that needs to be heard by so many people, that your information needs to get out because it's critical to the well-being and the mental health and the brain health of our future generations, Selena.
I know Kevin Campbell did some work in New South Wales where he does family finding and family seeing. So Child Connection seems like it's an offshoot of that incredible work that they've done to transform the into kinship care in the US.
Yes, that's right.
And I know that we're trying to develop ways of bringing him to Queensland as well, and Elizabeth Wendell's work. But I think that's really important. They show that people need. Yeah, kids, you can find people that want to look after kids that are outside the system.
Yes, absolutely. And it's critical. And you know what? This information is important for every household. Every household in every suburbia, like in every community. Can you share a bit about that why parents are so critical at this space?
Yes, so the thing that's come out through. I mean, it's intuitive, everyone knows this. But in reality, when you have a stressful life, which we all do, and raising children is stressful, it's a very hard job, right? And so it overwhelms you pretty quickly before you know it, even though you have best intentions when they're first born. But what we do know is that right from the beginning, as the first cells developing in utero, it's always about the connection to finding, the parent, like being with the parent. So it's called serve and return relationships. That's came out of Center for Developing Child at Harvard. I call it being seen to make it simpler for parents to understand that when a child feels like it's being seen by you, not for what you want it to be seen as. But how you really connect with that child, for that individual, because everyone is really quite different, even though they might look like you or be like you in certain aspects. The combination of the different genes just means that you're creating an individual that could have differences, if you know what I mean. And but when you feel like someone's really seeing you, and you talk a lot about this, even though you may not have had it in the direct parental relationship, you've had it in all of these community relationships. It was a game changer. Well, we know between the ages of 0 and 3 that if a child has that, one healthy adult is all it takes. It doesn't necessarily have to be the direct parent, that's obviously the best, but can be a grandparent, auntie, uncle, can be a friend or a mentor or a coach, but it's a very healthy person that believes in you 100%, has your back. That is a game changer for most brain health development of children. And is quite supportive and reduces, or it's like a protective factor, and that's why I call it being seen. It's one little tiny action that people can take. It's not tiny, obviously, because if it was easy, we'd all be doing it. But it is the silver bullet that everyone keeps looking for, and it's one healthy adult, basically. The more, the better. But you talk about this a lot in your piece. You
Yeah.
might have had it later, but doesn't matter, right? So what happens is in brain and child development, if children don't get this critical ingredient, because you can see kids are always looking to grab adult attention in using all sorts of strategies. And if they don't get that, then they seek it from other places. And why this online child exploitation grooming piece is so big in Australia is because if kids aren't getting it, that's why they're so easy to be groomed, or why it's so easy to tell them this is our secret, because it's the relationship that makes them feel seen. And that's what the groomers know too. So they're very clever, they know what they're doing, and little kids don't, right? So this is why being seen is such a critical ingredient for all of us to integrate into parenting, breastfeeding classes. So that it's something that we could do through. And the other thing that happened in 23 and 24 and recently, probably the last 8 to 10 years, is what you're noticing an upswing in the medication use in children and other things, is that's when screen time and phones accelerated. And they start to step in the place of an interaction between adults and children. And so that's something that's really big that's happened now in 24, because it's become so immersive and so normalized that we don't even notice that anymore.
As someone from the service system, Selena, the thing that struck me when I was listening to one of the podcasts, or it could have been in your book, was that parents are the only answer at the moment to what's happening on the online space. Can you talk to that bit? Because that was just profound for me.
Unfortunately, just because of where we sit right now and the normalization of technology, there are no government legislations around this being a public health issue. There is no tech company change to the algorithms to prevent this from happening to children right now. Australia doesn't have any safe devices, and there are so many ways, hundreds of ways, to be able to get to children. It's not just the simple social media platforms. There's many different messaging apps on all sorts of gaming devices, all sorts of apps that they can put on the phone to hide access. So parents, because we're not native, it looks okay to us and we think we've got some controls, but we actually don't know what our children are seeing online. It's a completely different set of things they're seeing compared to what we're seeing as well. And it all kind of went, ex it kind of exploded in the last year. I mean, obviously COVID accelerated it because we all went online more, but it's just something that's become a gap. And so why did I say only parents right now is because there is no other safe place, and it mainly is happening at home in bedrooms and bathrooms. And so we need to raise the awareness at first. And the other statistic that Madonna King wrote in her book called Saving Our Kids, where she did the work of John Rouse, who started Task Force Argos to try and break these networks in 20 years ago. They write in their book that only 3% of parents in Australia think it's happening to their children. And so so you can see the major gap. And
That
so
is.
if some and someone like you that's in the service industry with a lot of expertise, a lot of you're open-minded, you're always curious, you're asking questions. And the fact that this is still not something that's alarm bell central, and because in the service organizations, foster care, that they're the kids mainly being targeted on the extreme side of things, if you know what I mean.
How do we get this message out, Selena? Like, me connecting with you was such, like, my motivation was, how do we amplify this message? How do we
Yes.
act this?
So I believe strongly, Kelly, in the power of the parent, educator, healthy adult network. And what I mean by that is, just like we don't give our child a cigarette, and it's frowned upon if you do see a child smoking in a cafe.
I don't mean we don't.
But that took about a long time. We all used to smoke. So I believe in the power of the network, meaning that parents really love their children, want the best for them most of the time. Obviously, there's lots of situations under a lot of pressure that things happen. But ultimately, parents don't want that to happen. But nothing can change in if it stays in silence. And the more we keep talking about it, the more normalized that becomes. Whereas if it stays like in silence with no one wanting to talk about it, and there are a lot of people out there, by the way, trying to do this in very different ways. And I think we need to align all of those efforts into one big common echo chamber. And I think the big one I'm hearing that seems to make an easy message for people is delay use, delay use, delay smartphone and social media use as long as possible for children. At least that goes some way towards the safety. But there's a lot of pushback on that too, because they've been used as babysitting and
Respite.
respite, filling in lack of staff. You know, there's so many reasons why. I don't know what you're seeing out there on the field.
Yeah, absolutely. A screen is always given as a device to occupy, not as a tool to educate or interact with. Like, there's a difference with if there's something on a device that the parent's still interacting with the child and they're learning or they're developing, but that's very different to a child watching a screen and mum or trying to communicate or them trying to communicate with mum and mum's on a screen. There's no eye contact, there's no reaction or response to them. We're seeing children, copy the behaviors that they're watching on telly, sexualized songs that they're reenacting. They don't understand what that is, but they're reenacting that what they're watching.
Yeah, so that's the mirror neuron effect, which is why being seen is so important. That's how we learn, is through engaging face to face with other people. And that's the work of Joy Hirsch we talk about a lot. So she's actually being able to measure this interbrain synchrony, and now it's halved when we're on Zoom compared to when we're face to face, for example. The other thing that Mark Williams alluded me to was the still face syndrome I was telling you about, where kids are now not being able to use their faces properly because there's a screen between them and a human being.
Interesting that just even I was in a case conference today and they talked about the child coming home and having no effect on their face, no
Yeah.
interaction with their parents, no. Fascinating.
Yes, and so he's talking about how there are clinics opening up to help children learn to use their face. You and I were discussing before we came on about how, you know, we see people waiting in line for coffee, their child around their leg, they're on the phone, and the kids are pulling on them, looking up, looking at the screen, and then saying, "I love you," to try and get the attention.
It's heartbreaking. But
So.
it's normalized, and so I think it's about interrupting, not in a violent way, but just interrupting that to go, I'm curious about that.
Yeah.
To stop the blur and the noise of just every day, because we're in such a ritual and a habit of our engagement with devices and social media that we need that interruption to go, oh, I need to stop and think about that. Be
Yeah, and
curious about.
you were saying to me that one thing that resonated with you that might resonate with people listening is about the cigarette. Do you want to describe what you mean by that?
Well, I can't even fathom. I'm about to turn 50, and I can't even fathom any parent giving their child a cigarette, 5-year-old a cigarette, because we know the dangers. We know the impact of that. But we're not even blinking at giving them devices. Some parents I can see are hesitant to, but then there's no information really that they have access that it's damaging to them. They're just watching a show and it's just like watching telly. But what it is they're consumed with that and they're not having the other interactions. When telly first came in, you still had interactions and then you had some time, but now that is taking over. And I think if we gave the same evidence on the damage and the dangers and the risk to children, the fact that it is changing their brains. We're seeing so many children with who are not able to regulate, who have speech difficulties, who have developmental challenges in preschool. Like And more of the families we're seeing are having those challenges. And I think it's from the changing of the brain. If we had the same message, if we had the same awareness of the dangers and the risks, like you said, no parent wants to harm their child, but we don't see it as a harm. It's seen as a friend. It's not seen as a foe.
Yeah, so I guess that's why we came together is to work out, because you work across a lot of service organizations. You're a very big supporter. You understand the capacity for change, that it's never too late
Absolutely.
to make a change once, but you can't make a change unless you have the knowledge and education.
And you know what? We need to believe that people can change. And in some of my work, we work with some young parents, and like there might be multiple service involved, but you get a sense when people working with them believe that they can change, and they can get a sense when they don't believe they can change, and it's a really different outcome.
Well, I think what I've come to see, as an older person and been across so many different avenues, that if you believe someone can change, what that requires is you've got to do work. Meaning that you then are looking for all those sources that will drive the change. If you believe no one can change, then you don't do anything. You don't have to do anything. You just leave it the same because it's not worth. I hear this so many times in so many different decades of my life. Don't go there, not worth it, too hard, never possible, that can't happen, don't get involved. And these words probably resonate with you a lot, is
I do, and they're hard.
I found it impossible too. And I just, for me, they're fighting words.
They are. They're backing me in a corner, and I'm coming out.
And I just disagree with that, because it does take a lot of effort though. It means that you have to help someone get the same access to the same resources that you were granted without any effort. And what I mean by that is, I mean housing, support, community support, access to education, food, and safety, that you were born into that and you have no recognition that that is the biggest gift you'd be ever given in your life.
In Australia, we live in that, don't we?
And, I was in America for a long time, and people over there, a lot of people can be homeless overnight, that they don't have the same social systems. But people have that belief that people, it's you don't get involved. But I think this kind of work is personal.
It is. It's actually the humanity of the work. And I think without it, I think we're just marking time. But more than marking time, we're causing damage, because the longer that we stay disconnected from ourselves and each other, I think the further apart we travel.
The other thing I noticed too, Kelly, is that people don't think it matters. That won't affect them. And this is the bit that I really disagree with, because I think, as you write in your article about the interconnectedness, interwovenness, it does affect you, doesn't it? Because if you don't take care of your most vulnerable, the flip side is the village gets burnt down.
And it seems like a simple solution, and we know it's not a simple solution, but it's a solution that everyone can actually be a part of right now. It's not like we have to wait until we've achieved something or do something to be able to see someone else and to be able to connect with someone else on a really genuine level. It can happen by everyone right now. I think knowing that is really important.
I need to read a little bit of an excerpt from your article. Is that okay?
Yeah, for sure.
What began was a journey of finding hope and believing in the possibility that my life could be different. I found hope. I look for and find it daily, and my life today is a testament to possibilities. My purpose in that journey continues as I try to share the gift I've been given by planting seeds of hope and possibility for others. I'm so grateful for those who, during my darkest and stormiest days, reminded me of the sun coming up tomorrow and the rainbow that comes after the rain. Days when I had forgotten what the sun looks like and my only desire was what was beyond the rainbow. At first, I didn't believe them, and then I could only trust in the words as they continued to remind me and never gave up. I finally remembered the sun, and that does so much more than just cause sunburn. And I caught a glimpse of the rainbow. In celebrating the essence of Ubuntu, I need to acknowledge some very special people who crossed my path and the beautiful gifts that they've given to not only me, but to all humanity. They are the illuminators. When their light shines, it captures the imagination, their reflection and refraction, sending our living light and color.
Yeah.
That must
Amazing.
make you feel so good that you wrote that.
Oh, look, it was a gift. I was invited to write in it and I initially said no.
Yeah.
Then I said Marg would be great to write in it, the lady who I would be writing about. And then Dr. Terrorize said, no, we'd love you to write. And it just came together. I think it really honored the people, but the journey, and not the who, not just the who made a difference, but how they made a difference. And I think that's such an important message to share. We often don't know the how.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just love that piece. I might put a link up to the piece so other people can read it as well.
I can put a link to the book. I can send you one of them.
Yes,
So,
that'd be great.
yeah.
And then you finish off your CV by saying, trauma changed me, it changed my story, but it didn't end there. In owning my story, I found the strength and courage to write my own ending. It's a beautiful story of healing, connecting and belonging.
Yeah.
So
And
with
you know
that, yes.
the beautiful thing is that now I connect my lived experience with my professional experience. A staff member asked me a couple of years ago, how do I know what you know? And oh my goodness, that I felt that of the journey that I had walked. But then it sent me on a journey of how do I articulate this? And I think it is that I see you, I celebrate you, you matter. When that happens with another human being, something happens. It creates an energy, it creates a possibility. That's what I love. Yeah.
And after 30 years of working around the field to try and understand why my sister got a mental illness, it all came down to being seen as the silver bullet that probably would have changed her trajectory as well. And that's partly why I wrote that book. It's the scientific side of it, of course.
So
But
grateful for work. So grateful, Selena.
so
Yeah.
it meets the lived experience, and
Absolutely.
I think the future is a combination. All professional services and hospitals need to have lived experience professional people on the teams to bring back the compassion into the understanding of people's stories and.
Absolutely. And the possibility of what can be, I think we actually stop at the diagnosis, or we stop at the illness in its most, chronicest space. We actually don't see the victory. We don't see the change or transformation that can happen. My wisdom today is totally from my lived experience
Yeah.
and lived experiences along the way.
And how can you diagnose something that happened in early life without having a full understanding of this neural circuitry and pathways that have been disrupted as a consequence too? So I think that's just a missing piece in the whole DSM as well that needs to be integrated. I know Charles Nemiroff's trying to do that, but it's such a huge missing gap. That needs to come into all the clinical practices as well. And I don't think it's just for mental health. I think it's for physical health as well.
Absolutely.
And I think everyone has a lived experience.
I do too. I absolutely do. Otherwise, we're not living. I think too, I'm really curious of the space, Selena, that, from what happened to what's wrong with you to what happened to you to who are you. I think I'd be really interested in the decades to come to see what happens in that space when people connect with themselves and the magic within. Diversity and inclusion isn't a factor because actually everyone's celebrated as the unique person that they come as, and
Yes.
then they come with their strengths and the ability, and people can then see that rather than the difference. I think that space is very exciting, and I hope to just keep watching and being a part of
Hoping.
the future. Yeah.
Well, I think that's going to come possibly with the deindustrialization of the education system, because the
Ooh.
education system kind of put everyone into box. They need to be in similar boxes
Yeah.
to compete to get into, it's about competition, and so it actually is trying to rank people on
Yeah.
similar things. And I think that's part of the issue as well. That's going to have to. That's being dealt with somehow. I think that's part of the information technology, probably some of the good side, maybe
Yeah. Yeah.
that might come out of it. But would you like to say anything as we come to a close today to the audience?
Take a moment to pause, I guess, and just consider the people around you and in your life, and when you may be stopped and connected with them and saw them. Sometimes we just go on in the blur of life and don't do that. And I really encourage that we start to stop, pause, see each other, connect with each other, because that brings us a hope that we're here and we matter. Absolutely. And I think I certainly will be sharing your work, Selena. The value and the importance of your message of neuroplasticity and the impact that that can have in change. What I love is it's not about the deficit, but it's around the possibility of what we can do, not what is or what we're stuck in. And so that to me is really exciting work. So, look to forward to sharing your work as well.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for seeing lots of other people to help them have the opportunity to step into the same pathway that you were able to find through the connections with other people that saw you.
Thank you.